Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here in Madison. It's my first visit to your beautiful campus. It's a little windy, but otherwise I'm having a wonderful time. And so I'm so grateful to Professor Gerber and Jennifer and Danielle for inviting me to give this talk. I must say, having become director of the Russian and East European Institute, I feel like my research has sort of gotten on the back burner, and I feel like I don't have lots of opportunities to speak about it. So that's another reason that I'm really, really delighted to be here. If you have trouble hearing me, please let me know. I know that my voice doesn't carry so well. I often get phone calls at home, and they say, "Sweetie, is your mommy home?" so I realize that my voice doesn't carry probably to the back of the room. So just give me a signal if you're having trouble hearing me, please. So I guess I'll just get started. And what I'm going to talk about today is a research project that's been going on for the last 4 years. And as Professor Gerber was relating, previously to this, my research had focused in Ukraine a lot on civil society and social activism around different health issues, but I had not really gotten into the HIV world. And the HIV prevention world is a new place for me. I've had a lot of guidance, and I'm going to talk a little bit about our study team. But it's a new, very exciting area of research that I've been really gratified to be able to get into. The title of the research project is A Novel Bottom-Up Approach to Promote Evidence-Based HIV Prevention for IDUs, and IDU stands for Injecting Drug Users. You'll notice on our little seal that it says Medical College of Wisconsin. When the study was launched in 2012, our PI, Jill Acharzak, was at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and she has since moved on to Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. But we came up with this seal because anyone who's done research in Russia, Ukraine, or other parts of Eastern Europe knows you have to have that stamp, right, to make the paperwork official. So we had this seal that we've just kept with the project, sort of a reminder of our humble beginnings, I guess. It's a four-year project, and so we're actually wrapping the project up here at the end of the summer. It's been funded by NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which is part of the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. And it is a multifaceted, multidisciplinary, international project. So that's one of the really wonderful things for me. Up until this point, I have really been sort of that classic lonely anthropologist, you know, who goes out into the field and does the field work, produces, you know, the monograph. And I had not really done a lot of collaborative research. So it's been very much a gratifying learning experience in that way. So today, I realize that we have an interdisciplinary audience here, and so I've tried to sort of pitch my talk as an overview to give you a sense of what were the motivations of this research project, why have we structured it the way that we have, what are some of the difficulties that we've run into, what are the general contours of the methodology of the project? And then finally, what are some of the emerging findings that we've seen? So it's sort of a run through without getting into anything very specific, but I hope that during the question and answer period, you know, you'll feel free to ask questions about specific aspects or things that maybe I haven't mentioned. So that's the general sort of scope of the talk. It's pretty broad. So the project goals, in a nutshell, are to empower local HIV service agencies to develop their own HIV prevention interventions for the clients that they work with in their communities. This might sound like, well, yeah, of course, but this has not been done. And I'll talk a little bit about evidence-based HIV prevention interventions and the ways that they have failed in some contexts to take into account local economic context, local cultural context, and they're not very transferable. And so this project is hopefully a way to put the buy-in and the power to develop effective interventions in the hands of the true experts. right, the HIV activists who are on the ground in their local communities. So I'll say a little bit about who are these HIV service providing organizations that I'm talking about. They're NGOs, right? So they're non-governmental organizations that emerged in places like Ukraine after the fall of the Soviet Union, working in their communities on different advocacy issues. And the lay of the land in Ukraine is such that the majority of funding in the entire country that is focused on HIV prevention efforts comes from the Global Fund. The Global Fund to fight HIV, to fight AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. And the Global Fund channels its monies through one organization in Ukraine. It's an international charitable fund called the International HIV/AIDS Alliance in Ukraine. So in many ways, it's a very top-down structure, right? And it's a very donor-driven structure. So programs on the ground for HIV prevention in different communities are not bottom-up. They're more top-down, and they're speaking to the priorities of the Alliance and of the Global Fund. And NGOs are very financially dependent on the Global Fund. I'll tell you about the NGOs that are participating in our project, and a couple of them were 100% financially dependent on the Global Fund. They didn't have any other sources of financing. So I should point out that these NGOs are taking a harm reduction approach with injecting drug users. I'm going to talk about the epidemiology of HIV in Ukraine and why it's important to target injecting drug users. But they're taking a harm reduction approach, which is the idea that you can't stop everybody from taking risks. You can't stop everybody from doing drugs and doing harmful behaviors that we know and they know are harmful for their health. But you can help them do it in a safer way, right? You can help to reduce the harm that they're doing to themselves and others. It's really interesting because in Indiana right now, we have had an HIV outbreak in several counties that are fueled by injecting drug use. And there are lots of conversations about, you know, what are we going to do about this? You know, the HIV is rampant in these communities. What are we going to do? And so suddenly, this idea of harm reduction, it's like a light bulb moment for people. And I just want to say, they've been doing this in Ukraine, right, for 15 years. Maybe you should go learn something from the Ukrainians. So it's really interesting, this dynamic. But these NGOs are very much grounded in a harm reduction approach. And the idea with this research project, and it's very much an applied project, right? There are deliverables that you'll learn about. The idea is that these true experts, right, who are the activists on the ground who have been working in HIV prevention for 15, 20 years, some of them, whose own lives have been touched by drug use and HIV and other infectious diseases, that they shouldn't have to rely on prepackaged interventions to reach their clients. And that they really have the knowledge that is necessary for success of HIV prevention efforts. So I'll say a little bit about the study team. The PI on the project is Jill Acharzak, who I mentioned is at Johns Hopkins University now. And we have a research team on the ground in Ukraine in Karazin, Kharkiv University. Olga Filipova, Tatiana Zub, and Polina Alpatova are on the ground research assistants. Olga Filipova is actually a co-investigator. Alyona Mazhnaya is at Kiev Mihyla Academy. She also works for the Alliance. And Rosanna Alexanyan is at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And as I said, the study sponsor is the National Institute on Drug Abuse. So this is the research team that helped develop and implement this, this research project. So a little bit of background on the epidemiology of HIV in Ukraine. historically, well, I don't know if you know or not, but Ukraine has the highest rates of HIV in all of Europe. Historically, the HIV epidemic there has been fueled by injecting drug use. And recently, it appears that we have a situation where the epidemiology is switching and heterosexual sex is the main vector of transmission now in Ukraine. So we've seen that bridge from IDUs to from injecting drug use to sexual transmission. But injecting drug users are still a very, very important part of the picture. So for example, in 2011, 38.4% of new infections did occur in injecting drug users. There have been some studies that show that among people who inject drugs in Ukraine, about 40% are HIV positive. And in some areas, Odessa Oblast in particular, one study found that 55% of people who inject drugs are HIV positive. So it's still a very important population to target with HIV prevention efforts. There are an estimated 340,000 people living with HIV/AIDS in Ukraine right now. That's the official estimate, and the unofficial estimates are much, much higher. So many believe that it's probably about twice that because of specifics of sort of testing, the testing environment and things that I won't get into. And so this is one of the reasons why most HIV prevention efforts in Ukraine are still focused on injecting drug users. Many of them focus almost solely on injecting drug behaviors and not sexual behaviors. And so that's another thing that we are covering in our study, given the current sort of shift in the epidemic. More background about the drug use contexts in Ukraine. One of the reasons that it's been so difficult to address the HIV epidemic in Ukraine is that there's a really specific drug preparation, buying and selling, and use culture. And so if in the United States, for example, people who use opiates, people who inject opiates, usually buy them in powdered or in tar form and mix them with liquid and boil them themselves for self-injection. In Ukraine, it's a totally different drug preparation scene. Drugs are prepared in a common pot by so-called cookers, who then usually distribute the drugs themselves, sometimes selling the drugs in liquefied form in pre-loaded syringes. So you can see that the possibilities for HIV infection are multiplied, right? When you have a common pot that we don't know, you know, how clean it is, when you have pre-filled syringes that people are buying and selling, and you also have a lot of group use. So people use these liquefied drugs in groups, and they might buy a big syringe, which they then share. And so you have people bringing their own syringes, front loading, right, pulling drugs into their own syringe from a common syringe, or back loading, right, pouring the drug into the back of the syringe from a common syringe. So you can see it's a really complicated, right, environment. It's not enough to just say, always use a sterile needle, right? You can use a sterile needle, but you didn't have control over where the drugs were being cooked. You didn't have control over the preloaded syringe from which you're getting your own dose. So, sorry, too much information. I get excited about this. So these are the unique injection and drug use practices, and the drug scene has changed dramatically, actually, even during the last 4 years that we've been doing this study. So it used to be opiates. It used to be this locally produced liquid poppy straw. And I love the Russian and Ukrainian term. They literally call it artisanal poppy straw, right? Because it's made at home, right, in small batches, which locally is called hemia. But we've seen a huge increase in stimulants. And so these are also homemade, also artisanal, ephedrine-based stimulants, much like methamphetamine. So it's basically various variations on a theme of ephedrine-based stimulants. And so in addition to the unique injection and drug use practices, of course, we also worry about needle sharing, right? We also worry about injecting drug users not using a clean needle every time or not cleaning out their needle with cold water and bleach every time if they are going to reuse it. So lots of background here before I can get to the good stuff. Okay, so study motivations, right? There have been a lot of programs in Ukraine and places like Ukraine with IDUs, right, trying to use this harm reduction approach to help people stop taking as many risks and hopefully reduce their risk for HIV infection. But the rates are still high, right? Maybe the rates would be even higher if we hadn't had these programs in place. But the number of registered people living with HIV has doubled in Ukraine every year since 2000. So clearly existing programs are not enough. Existing programs focus on information dissemination, so informing drug users about their risks, right? Teaching them less risky behaviors. Believe me, these clients and these NGOs who are injecting drug users and who come to utilize the services, they know much more than anybody else about risks for HIV and how to avoid those risks, but they still don't do it. So then what do we do, right? They're informed to death about their risks, basically, and that's what these NGO activists told us, that information dissemination is not enough. Just giving people sterile needles also is not enough, right? For some of the reasons I talked about. But if just distributing needles is not coupled with some kind of behavior change motivation, right, you're probably not going to see a lot of results. There's also very low government support for HIV programs, probably because it's always been a problem of those injecting drug users, right? Not the most politically or economically powerful group in the country, the socially marginalized. And so the Ukrainian government has taken very, very little interest in any of these programs or these problems. And so when the Global Fund came in to Ukraine, the whole idea was that they would set things up, get things jump started, and then all these programs would be taken over by the Ukrainian government. And unfortunately, that hasn't happened. So current prevention, HIV prevention efforts need to be expanded to include evidence-based strategies that seek to change risk behavior, do not require broad policy changes or political support, and that address the multiple HIV risks that drug users face. So, in a nutshell, there have been programs in Ukraine for HIV prevention. A recent study done by USAID did an intervention inventory, basically it was sort of a meta study of all the programs that have been launched in Ukraine, and they found out that at least 60% of them don't show efficacy, right? They don't seem to be effective. They're not working. Our team wondered what can be done differently. And so our project, the bridge project, it's really kind of a natural experiment. And it is a natural experiment that has tried to integrate the insights of anthropology into public health research and public health work. So we have been trying to apply anthropological methods and insights into the problem. We have taught service providers what are called common factors of HIV prevention interventions. And I'm going to say a little bit more about what I mean by common factors and what those are and why that's a useful concept here. We've trained providers to develop interventions based on these common factors. We have assessed the agency's ability to develop and implement these interventions. And then finally, we are planning to evaluate the effectiveness of the HIV prevention interventions that these NGOs develop. Do they work? Right? That's the fundamental question. Do these interventions work to help people reduce their risk for HIV and to stimulate behavior change? So, you know, what's the problem? We already have lots of evidence-based interventions for HIV prevention. If you go to the CDC website, you'll find 150 of them, okay? So there's a lot out there. Why don't we just take those, give them to the Ukrainians, right? Why don't we just say, okay, this works. You guys try it too. Well, any anthropologist would tell you, right? There are a lot of cultural specificities that you have to think about, lots of factors that mean that you can't just pick up one intervention that's been successful in one location with one population in one community and hand it to another community and expect it to work. There are 9 evidence-based interventions. When I say evidence-based, I mean that they have been studied and they've been shown to be effective, right? There are 9 of these interventions that focus on injecting drug users in particular. Okay, so 9 out of this over 150. But it's really difficult for service providers to take one of these prepackaged evidence-based interventions and just transplant it to the clients that they're working with in their local conditions, you know, in their sort of culturally specific environments. And one of the problems that's been identified is that these evidence-based interventions, they tend to rely on what are called core elements of effective interventions. And so these are basically integral features of the intervention that has to be present for it to be effective. That's the thinking anyway. And so what research has found is that it's really difficult for on-the-ground service providers who are, you know, doing this work to take those core elements and implement them with fidelity. This is public health talk. implement them with fidelity. And, you know, it seems like a great missed opportunity, right, to utilize the expertise of these NGO activists who have been doing this work, who know the lay of the land, who know the drug scene, who know their clients, who are really have a lot of respect and recognition in their communities. It would seem that there would be a better way to utilize their expertise. So we decided, let's test this. Let's see if this idea can work, that local service providers might be better situated to develop their own interventions. So we designed a project that relies on the theoretical idea of common factors rather than core elements. So instead of delivering prepackaged interventions that include these must-be-implemented aspects, I sort of think of this as I think of core elements as focus on content, right? So you must have this discussion, right, in your intervention. You must include this exercise in exactly this way in your intervention. Those are examples of core elements, right? But when you step back and you do a meta analysis of all these evidence-based interventions, and Rotherham Boris et al. Did such a meta-analysis, they found that actually there are things in common that all these, you know, excellent, very effective interventions have, and we can group them. We can figure out what they have in common, and so we can provide people with a framework instead of content, and we can provide them with the format instead of the content, and then let them use their own creativity and expertise to fill in the content. So it's sort of a framework approach that gives local service providers a lot more flexibility to think about what is my target group, right? Who are my target population? What's the drug use environment in which they are operating? What specific risks does this population have? And so it's a more flexible approach. Why are HIV prevention NGOs ideal for this quote-unquote natural experiment? Well, it's for all the reasons that I have mentioned. They've been working in this field for a long time. They're very agile, right? These local NGO activists are a lot more agile than the Alliance or the Global Fund or Western researchers, right? A lot of them, and this is true for these two guys in this picture, are themselves former members of the quote-unquote target group, okay? So Max and Oleg from Poltava, they said it's okay if I share their story. You know, they are former injecting drug users, very heavy injecting drug users, very infamous in their communities, and they have been doing this work for almost 10 years now. You know, they turn their lives around. People trust them, right? Because they know the problem from the inside. They don't judge people. They have a lot of cred, basically, because they've been there. And you know, these are precisely the kinds of people that a marginalized community, like people who inject drugs, are going to trust. And so for all of these reasons, we thought it was a really good idea to involve these local NGOs in the project. The study has a mixed methods design. So I'm basically the kind of lead ethnographer on the project. I was brought in as an ethnographer and an expert on NGOs and civil society in Ukraine. But we've basically been following the agencies that are participating in the study through this whole process and trying to document the whole process. So right now we're kind of drowning in data, right? We've got a lot of documentation of how this natural experiment has gone, and I won't get into a lot of the details here, but we did choose 8 NGOs as our initial participants, and then we assessed the interventions that they had developed and piloted in their own communities, and then we chose 4 that have continued on for the final 2 years in the study and that have actually implemented their intervention with their clients in their organizations. And of course, we provided money and support for them to do so, right? So in every stage of the process, we've been helping facilitate things on the ground. We've been consulting with them, and we have provided them funds that they need to pay staff, to pay incentives to the clients who are going through these workshops, and also for technical things that they need, laptop computers and other things for administering the surveys that we've asked them to administer. So we called for applications. I'm sort of going to walk you through start to finish the project. We called for applications for NGOs in Ukraine that wanted to participate in this project. And so it's a self-selected group, right, who saw our call for applications and said, yes, we'd like to do that. That sounds interesting. And so I think we got about 15 applications, and from those we selected 8 that we felt like were best positioned to participate. We had asked them to fill out a questionnaire about, you know, what are your motivations? How do you see this fitting within the general mission of your NGO, and lots of, you know, other details about the NGO. So these are the sites, the 8 sites in which the organizations were located. I know it's hard to see, so I will tell you. Simferopol was one in Crimea, Odessa, Mykolaiv, Zaporozhye, Dnipropetrovsk, Slavyansk, which is near Donetsk, Poltava, and Kiev. So those were our initial 8 organizations, which later became 4 organizations. We assigned research assistants to each organization, and so they had a main consultant on our team. So they always had somebody that they could go to with questions and to, you know, ask for feedback and so on. We conducted baseline organizational histories with all of these groups over Skype, actually. And then based on that information, we developed really detailed interview schedules that we used during summer 2013 to do in-depth interviews with basically all the staff members of all the agencies that would have sort of anything to do with this intervention. So we did a lot of ethnographic work during that summer of 2013 to learn more about the organizations from lots of different perspectives. Then at the end of that summer, we invited 2 representatives from each of the organizations to a training, and these were supposed to be 2 representatives that would be responsible for designing and implementing the HIV prevention intervention at their own agency. So they came to Odessa, and we had a 3-day training where we introduced them to lots of the sort of theoretical principles on which the project was based. We included examples from those 9 evidence-based interventions that I told you about that exist. But we took them through materials and steps that they might use in developing their own interventions. And I brought the training manual to show you if you're interested. Pass that around for those of you that have Russian. So we basically got them ready to develop their own interventions, right? And then we set them loose. And they had 6 months to develop an intervention. And we asked them to manualize it. So in other words, we asked them to create an intervention manual that went along with their program that they would use in their piloting and in their subsequent interventions, and that would give this project more of an afterlife, right? If it's manualized, it's a guide that others could use after that. So we asked them to keep in mind the 5 overarching theoretical concepts that have been identified as important for behavior change and that transcend any individual theory and drug user specific risks. So their interventions had to keep in mind these principles of behavior change theory because that was the framework, right? That was the sort of common factors framework that we wanted all of them to cover. So risk perceptions and appraisal, self-perception, emotion and arousal, relationships and social influences, and environmental and structural factors. So for example, just a few examples on risk perceptions and appraisal, a lot of them had the participants in their intervention do an initial risk assessment, right? And it was often called, am I at risk for HIV, right? And so it asked them to answer survey questions about their behaviors so that they could see how their behaviors might translate into them being more or less at risk for HIV. So they came up with these interventions in manuals. We evaluated the manuals. We asked them to also videotape their pilot programs with their clients. This is someone putting a condom on a banana. So all the interventions included lots of skill building and role playing and practicing of skills. And that was one thing that was important, and I'll tell you why in a second. But we wanted to see, right? We couldn't be there in Ukraine, but we wanted to see what the interventions were looking like, how they were piloting them with their clients. And so that was another way that we used to assess the interventions and give them feedback. Did I skip a slide? Oh, yes. Okay, so the common factors. I keep talking about common factors that we wanted them to include. Here's what they are. Right, this is from that meta study that I was talking about. So the interventions needed to be multi-session, so 6 to 8 sessions. So basically you can think of it as a mini workshop, right? And so they took their clients through these sessions over the course of a few weeks. Most of the groups included 6 to 10 participants because they had to be in small group format. This is some of the content that they needed to include, but what exactly that content looked like was totally up to them, right? And so they could use their own creativity, they could use their own knowledge of, you know, their clients and their life situations and their economic situation and everything else, as long as they, you know, were targeting these topics. There was a lot of peer group discussion, like I said, modeling, demonstrations, and role-playing. And again, this is all coming from behavior change theory, the idea that for people to change their behavior, they need motivation, they need practice, they need time, and they need constant encouragement. Okay, and so that is one of the sort of core principles of this whole intervention. So what kinds of interventions did these 8 agencies come up with? I won't go through all of these. You can see them yourselves, but you'll notice that there are very target groups. CSW stands for commercial sex workers. And so some of them targeted women who inject drugs and are commercial sex workers, and in Ukraine, commercial sex workers tend to inject drugs. The two go together. Some of them included women only in their interventions, and some of them included men and women. The preference for women in some cases reflects the priorities of the specific NGOs, but it also reflects the fact that women are increasingly at risk for HIV in Ukraine. So it was interesting that the epidemiological trends were reflected in the choices that the agencies made. Let's see. They also were really sensitive to what kinds of clients did they want to reach, right? So for example, the agency in Odessa said, we have this whole group of injecting drug users that have utilized all our programs, they come to all our events, and they continue to share needles. We gotta find a way to reach these people. One organization, the one in Poltava, actually said, you know, we've been working with opiate users for so long, we don't know what to do with these stimulant users, right? It's a whole new generation of kids, basically, using drugs that we don't know that much about. We don't know that much about this population, and we're having trouble reaching them. So they wanted to use the intervention as a way to get these new clients into their organization. So some of the strengths that we found in kind of taking the organizations through this project is that they really like it. They feel good being seen as the experts, right? That their expertise is acknowledged. Granted, it's a self-selected group, right? They applied to participate in the project. So it's not something that's being foisted, you know, upon activists who didn't want to do it. But I think they themselves are surprised at how much they have gotten out of the project and how much their clients seem to have as well. And, you know, it's fulfilling a lot of the things that we hoped that it would. You know, that they're really honing in on particular problems that they haven't been able to address so far with their clients, and they're using it as an opportunity to either expand their services or refine their services or, you know, whatever they see as being most important. So that's been really great. The challenges are ones that you might expect. For some of them, it's really hard to identify what is that target population that we want to reach, right? Some of them started with really broad target populations, some of them started too narrow. It's been difficult for them to balance information, theory, and skills building. It's just like developing a lecture, right? How do you balance this and this? How do you balance the theory and the ethnography? How do you, you know, how do you balance things in your teaching, in your writing? It's the exact same thing here, right? How do you package this in a way that's digestible, but also gets across your main points? So I would say that also, you know, the fact that this grant was written for NIDA specifically to focus on injecting drug use and HIV prevention, that actually has been a limiting factor, right? Because some of the agencies say, gosh, you know, our clients need so many more services, or our clients are at risk not only for HIV, but for other things. Do we have to focus on HIV? And we're like, well, yeah, that's what we got the money for, right? And so there are other directions that could have been productive that they wanted to go in that just weren't possible because of the constraints of the funding. I should say that hepatitis C is really the epidemic to watch out for in Ukraine right now. And in fact, I was just going through some of the quantitative data yesterday, and in some of the cities that we are focusing on, let's say 150 people took the survey, 150 injecting drug users. In some places, at least a third of them have been diagnosed with hepatitis C. So it's very rampant. So again, if they had had more flexibility, you know, they might have focused on that. Okay, which programs went forward in the study is the ones that are in yellow, and so I can just tell you that it was Poltava, Odessa, Nikolaev, and Slavyansk. And so, as you might imagine, some of the decisions about who was going to go forward were easier than others. But we had quite an adventure with Slavyansk when their city was captured by the separatists. And we were Skyping with our agency staff from a basement of a building when they were, you know, rockets were flying. We also didn't quite know what to do with Simferopol after the annexation of Crimea by Russia, but in the end they didn't end up going forward, unfortunately, in the in the project. But the ones that we didn't select to take their clients through the intervention, and the target was 130. So the idea was that they are doing these small group sessions, right, these mini workshops, and they're taking 130 clients through the intervention. So it's about, for some of them, it's about 20 contact hours, right? 16 contact hours. This one was amazing, right? 10 sessions of 4 hours each. It's a long day. 40 contact hours. So they're taking these groups through the intervention, and they're doing pre and post surveys, right, to assess what are people's behaviors, either injecting drug behaviors or sexual behaviors, before they go through the intervention, and then 90 days after the intervention, what are their behaviors, right, to see did it work, right, did they change their behaviors. Of course, we're also assessing things like income, you know, employment status, housing, you know, all kinds of factors that you might imagine would be important also, you know, environmentally for people's risk behaviors as well. So I think I basically just said this. The agencies are taking their clients through the interventions. Most of them are almost finished, but they still have some follow-up to do, and they're still trying to get people to come do those post-intervention surveys. As you might imagine, losing study participants to follow up has been a problem. It's not the most stable population that we're working with here. We've also recorded more sessions of the intervention, which we'll be analyzing. And we're going to be conducting follow-up interviews with at least two members of each staff about their experiences with the project, and so on. So again, I can't tell you does it work yet, unfortunately. I'll hope to be able to tell you that by the fall, when all of the data is in and we can see, you know, are these interventions that the agencies came up with themselves effective in getting clients to reduce their risk behaviors. So I can't give you the punchline quite yet, but I can tell you some of the emerging research results. I just want to really quickly relate to you a few messages from the agencies themselves. We had a project meeting in November and invited the agencies to come and talk about their experiences. And we were really delighted to see that some of them have really integrated this program into their, you know, sort of menu of services, right? And some of them are really excited about maybe expanding this in new directions, maybe using their intervention to reach out to new client groups, and so on. So this agency director said, we can use the practical experience in designing and carrying out the intervention in our work with other client groups. This program director thought, this says that what's the difference between this project and other projects that we've done in the past, and she really valued the fact that she said, we're developing our own programs, not implementing someone else's. So the agencies really took ownership over this. They say it was interesting. They liked being part of research. There's this sort of stereotype that NGO activists, you know, aren't interested in research. But these agencies really were. They found it really valuable. And so that was really nice for us to hear too. Sorry, I don't have time to translate all of this, but the gist of this is an agency, one of the facilitators, talking about how seriously the clients had taken this experience, and that she really saw a lot of changes in them personally. So it's sort of like it's exactly what you want with a behavior change approach, that it's internalized, that people start thinking about their lives and their behaviors, and trying to make changes. And this agency director said that they would try to share their expertise with others who are working in the field. And we were really happy to hear that too, of course. So these are some questions that we'll be considering, and basically it boils down to, is this something that can be replicated and scaled up, right? So this approach that we've tried to launch in Ukraine with these eight agencies, is this something that would be useful in general in the HIV prevention world? Is it a good alternative, you know, anthropologically informed to the prepackaged evidence-based interventions that sort of, you know, hit the ground in different places and then fall apart? So that's a question that we'll be asking. It's obviously a time and resource intensive approach, right? And so how scalable will it be? We're not sure, but we hope that it will be. So these are some of the topics that have emerged as being really interesting to analyze further just from our preliminary data. You know, like I mentioned, we don't have the kind of survey data in yet to look at how risk behaviors have changed, but with all the ethnography that we've been doing, we do have a lot of other types of data. And as you might imagine, gender has emerged as a huge thing, right? You notice that several of the organizations focus their work specifically on commercial sex workers. And women's escalated risks for HIV in lots of different contexts is something that has been getting a lot of attention lately. So we've applied for a follow-up grant to look at some of the gendered aspects. A lot of these agencies have what they call gender-sensitive programs, and it's kind of fascinating to see what that means to them, what they see a gender-sensitive program is. Sometimes it means providing a kindergarten, right? And so it can be based on, you know, sort of gender norms there that may or may not, you know, be empowering to women, and that's an open question, something that we'd like to look at. One of our researchers is doing a latent class analysis of drug use patterns and safe sex behaviors, looking at the different regions, right? We have the data from these different regions, so it's really interesting to see what are the differences across the regions that really fuel people's behaviors and their risks. And it's been fascinating for me just looking at some of the survey data to see how different some of these client groups are, the target groups. So the commercial sex workers make, their income is three times everybody else's. They tend to live in their own homes. They tend to own their own apartments. They tend to inject drugs alone, which actually puts them at less risk of HIV. And so it's just a totally different target group that you're working with. And looking at those differences is really, really interesting. So these are some of the topics for ongoing analysis. And I think I'm ready for questions. That's the natural experience. Thank you so much. So thanks for letting me share all these gory details with you. And I assume you have questions about something. Yes.
Lori, many thanks for your talk. Actually, I wonder, could you talk more about how do these NGOs reach out to some sensitive target client groups, and how prevalent are those groups to retreat from these treatment?
Okay. Sure. So again, over the years, you know, these NGOs have really, really perfected their outreach techniques and their outreach strategies. Like I mentioned, many of them are from the quote-unquote target group, right? So some of these agencies are staffed by former drug users, some of them are staffed by current drug users. So what they would call episodic users, right? Maybe people who don't use chronically, but at times they get back into the system. So they know the scene. They know it's really important that these NGOs, they know the local law enforcement environment as well. And so some of them have reached out and formed partnerships with the local police. They form partnerships with the local government. And so they're really trying to work towards a decriminalization of their clients. But there are still groups that the agencies say it's really difficult for them to reach. So one thing they do is they rely on peer-driven, right, outreach. And so they're constantly getting new people into their programs who they then hope will take the information and bring their friends to the group. They also have mobile clinics, and so many of them have these sorts, like a bus, basically, kind of like a medical bus that they take around on a certain schedule and do consultations. Some of them have healthcare, like medical facilities right in those buses. They do HIV rapid testing from those buses. But it's really, peer-driven, and it's based on, you know, them having to be really, really agile.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for a fascinating talk. I was struck by a couple of things. First of all, I wanted to compliment you on the nuances of tracing, you know, from the IV drug use pattern into the STD, you know, the sexually transmitted pattern, mm-hmm. and the attention to gender. We were noticing that all the members of your team, were women.
Yeah.
We were also noticing a save the women thing here, going on. So a couple of related questions. Do you think that your team members were more accepted as women as either less threatening or more of a sort of a social workery kind of, mm-hmm. you know, helping profession kind of approach? One thing, and also do you think that the activist groups thought that women were more rescuable, mm-hmm. in some mm-hmm. sense, more potentially compliant? Mm-hmm. You know, so what are some of those gender power things, and mm-hmm. how did it play out in your research?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I need to think more deeply about that. It was very interesting that our team was all women. It didn't start out that way. We did have a couple of men on our team, but one retired and one decided he didn't have time for this. And actually the dynamic did change, I have to say.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, funny that, right? When Tony retired, the dynamic changed a little bit. But, I mean, throughout the whole, it was always clear, I think it was always clear, that these activists were the experts, whether they were men or whether they were women. And so I think it probably made a difference in some of the organizational context. And it also meant that because the organizations here, you know, several of them were women focused and were focused on the commercial sex workers. You know, we as women researchers had more access to the outreach work they were doing. So we could go with them on the mobile clinics to the streets. We didn't interview their clients, but we could be present, right, when discussions were going on or things were happening, medical gynecological exams. I mean, we weren't watching, obviously, but we were around. It helped. It gave us a certain kind of access. But I have to say, but there were tensions. And there were tensions with the groups that said we have a gender-sensitive approach. But we as as researchers and as feminists, I mean, I'm a feminist anthropologist, we had problems with their definition of gender sensitivity. And it cut off some avenues of conversation. So thank you for your question. I need to think about it more. I really do. And I'd love to talk to you about it more. Yeah. Yes?
It's probably inevitable, but would you be willing to share with us any of your preliminary results or what you think is the direction that things are going to go?
I haven't seen the follow-up data, so I don't know. I've only seen the baseline data. And so some things that I noticed in the baseline data, you know, that are interesting are precisely the different challenges that different target groups are facing. Drug use patterns are so different. In one city, I guess I can say which one it was, in Slavyansk, it's very much the norm to use as a group. And literally zero respondents said, I never shoot up with other people. And in other cities, it was different. It was more of like a, you know, straight line, sometimes, occasionally, you know, never. But in Slavyansk, it was like this. and so those kinds of differences were really interesting. But I apologize, I have not seen the follow-up data, so I can't say anything about it. We're all on pins and needles, right? And you know, we're worried that this is going to flop, right? Like, what if these interventions don't work? We just spend a lot of time and resources to find that out. But we tell ourselves that's a finding too, right? Yeah.
So, I mean, a bit more about your experimental setup or your so do you have control groups in the regions who were not subject to the interventions? Because presumably over time, there's some, you know, equilibrium process whereby some people adapt, change behavior changes regardless of the intervention.
Yeah.
To make the case that an intervention is effective, it seems like you need to compare, you know, those who are subject to the intervention, their rate of adapting a new behavior to the rate among those who do not experience intervention.
Yeah, no, we don't have control groups. And so the idea is that we're going to compare the efficacy of these interventions with interventions that have been studied already, whether in Ukraine or elsewhere. And so there have been interventions that have, like SHIELD. SHIELD is a really famous one that has been done in Ukraine, and you know, we have studies and how effective has it been. So that's something that we're going to compare to. It won't be with the same populations, right? It won't be in the exact same cities or with the same exact target groups. But we're really interested in, you know, in this localized context, does it work? Which can be a problem, right? Because I've already talked about how the drug scene changes, right? Things, you know, tend to change. It's not a real stable situation in Ukraine right now. You know, what happens, like maybe these interventions work now, but what happens a year from now, right? How agile can these agencies be? Are they going to want to invest the time and resources to tweak their interventions for this new context? So that's, you know, that's a limitation of the study and a reason we wonder how scalable is it. Yeah, but we're not comparing with control groups. Although other researchers have done that. In the SHIELD studies, they looked at behaviors amongst those who participated in SHIELD and those who didn't. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In terms of replicability, do you have any sense of from the participants of your projects, which is those NGO experts, of the efficacy of their own interventions in terms of what's really working and what's the innovative aspect of it that is making a difference versus what they've been doing already many years ago and didn't work?
Yeah.
And then if it is replicable, mm-hmm. in that sort of cultural context, what are some of the funding sources do you think you could potentially go for if it works?
Yeah, great question. The agencies really love the behavior change
model.
They really like it. And it's so interesting because, you know, in anthropology of post-socialism and in kind of post-socialist studies, you know, there's lots of critiques of, you know, that sort of the neoliberal model, you know, being brought in, and it focuses on, you know, the individual and what can the individual do and self-motivation, and screens out, right, a lot of the social factors, a lot of the environmental and structural factors that put people at risk. And we recognize that limitation, believe me. But the agencies like it. You know, they say, you know, in our, you know, in our, in the daily grind, you know, we can't change the laws. You know, we're trying. And I want to emphasize that they're doing this intervention with the behavior change model alongside all different kinds of advocacy projects that they have, right? So they are reaching out to law enforcement. They are trying to get, you know, legislation tweaked. They are trying to address a lot of the social and environmental factors. But they like the behavior change approach. And it was this quote. I don't know if you read Russian or
I
not.
Did.
Okay,
I
yeah. So, you know, this quote about how our clients are internalizing this, right? They're changing. And then it's really interesting to see, they say, you know, but we have to point out this very important aspect that with, with life changes come a lot of demands, right? So when people start changing their behaviors and changing their lives, we need to help them get their documents in order. We need to help them get their living situation in order. We need to help get them registered, right? Employment. And so it's like it escalates, right, what their needs, right? Because now they're not just thinking about where they're going to get that next fix. They're thinking about life strategies. But that's one thing that they really like about it. They talk about a sense of camaraderie in those groups. You know, they're really intensive. And if you're sharing your deep, dark experiences with six other people who understand you really well, and you're doing that for 20 or 40 hours, you're going to develop, you know, a certain rapport in that group. So that's another thing that they really like. In terms of funding sources, I mean, that's the question. I mean, I think Jill might think differently, but if it turns out that this experiment worked, right, that this is a model that we want to propose, you know, be expanded, I think we would probably go to that, the alliance, the International HIV/AIDS Alliance in Ukraine, and try to work with them to scale it up. Or go to the Global Fund? I don't know. who do you ask for these things, Ted? I mean, I don't know. We'll ask Ted, and he'll help.
Pretty good.
yeah. But and that's, you know, that's something that we struggle with as well. You know, oh, you know, the project's ending. They have this great program. We have no more money to support them to do it. You know, or we're leaving them in a lurch. So, sort of. Connecting those dots, I think, is a conversation we're definitely going to be having with the research team. Can we give this an afterlife? Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, so I was just curious about when you were first advertising or first targeting NGOs.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of noticed, you know, it's more like central South. And I know that, like, the HIV rate is higher anyway in those sort of more heavily industrialized areas.
Yeah.
But did you advertise across the whole country?
Mm-hmm.
Was it just in Russian? Was it Russian Ukrainian? I mean,
mm-hmm.
What were sort of the avenues you know, collecting research?
Yeah. Thank you for that question. And I should have mentioned the fact that, yes, the HIV epidemic is very much centered in south central and eastern Ukraine. We did advertise through the alliance that I was talking about. They have all of these, Rasilki, right? They have all of these listservs, right, that they send out all kinds of information. So we advertised to anyone who had ever had anything to do with the alliance. They would have gotten a call. And all the applications came from basically South Central and Eastern Ukraine. We were hoping to get an applicant from Western Ukraine, but we didn't, and so that's what we went with. Language-wise, it was an easy decision to focus all our materials and everything in Russian, because that was the preferred language of each and every participant from the agencies. You know, we asked them, you know, what language would you like the materials in, and they all said Russian. So, you know, if they had wanted it in Ukrainian, we certainly would have produced that, but they didn't.
Yeah, the interventions triggered some discussion about the needs of these individuals after, you know, like their treatment, you know, the new challenges of finding a job or you know, applying for other benefits.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if there was any discussion from these interventions, whether it prompted discussions about prevention and reaching out perhaps to schools. Is that, I mean, that seems like a
mm-hmm.
challenge itself,
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
talk about these issues with
mm-hmm.
students.
Yeah, that's a good question as well. Some of them did have plans to talk about HIV prevention with school groups. It's really hard to do that in Ukraine, right? And so, because it's you know, drug use and sex are taboo topics, particularly in schools, right? It was hard for them to find an in. Interestingly, sort of going off topic here, but the SHIELD intervention that I talked about that has been, it's also peer-driven. It's something that was developed at Johns Hopkins and then disseminated in different places. So they did SHIELD in Ukraine, and it's a peer-driven intervention. So people go out and recruit, right, friends, client, well, their peers, for the intervention. And so Robert Booth, from University of Colorado, did a comparative study of SHIELD and individual consultations, and showed that actually the SHIELD intervention, which was small group, was not effective in Ukraine in helping people change their safe sex behaviors, whereas the one-on-one consultations were. And so the sort of conclusion was that it's still, even, you know, even today, even among adults, you know, it's still hard to talk about sex in a group setting. And so people were okay talking about it one-on-one with a counselor and then changing their sexual behaviors, but not in a group. And so that just goes, my point is, if it's difficult for these, you know, adults who have been there, done that, to talk about it, it's really difficult to talk about it in schools.
Yeah. Okay, one last question.
I was just going to ask if you might say a little bit more about that follow-up, about why in the Russian language-speaking regions there might be more HIV or drug use. I mean,
uh-huh.
It's a funny thing about Ukraine that those language divides map on to so many other issues, one after another.
Yeah.
So I just wonder if you know why that would be.
Yeah, it has partially, so Odessa and Nikolaev are port cities, right? Simferopol being in the Crimea, also sort of that, lots of back and forth, right? Lots of people moving in and out. But it also has to do, as far as I understand, it also has a lot to do with the way that the drug trade developed, both during the Soviet period and then after Ukraine became independent. So you have a lot more drug use in these port cities in particular. I don't know sort of the situation with Donetsk and Slavyansk and that, but I do, it has a lot to do also, I think, with economics. I'm no expert on this, you know, sort of subject, but when we were doing our ethnography in Slavyansk, the local economy was so depressed that when I found out, when we heard that, you know, the separatist movement had really taken hold there, and you know, all of these things had happened, I wasn't surprised. It seemed like a place that was ripe for this kind of turmoil. But I need to look more at why the epidemiology is like that, and why it's centered in those regions. But it's historically it's been that way economically and with the drug, the kind of drug trade.
Okay, thank you very much again, Sarah.